Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much.
We are on strike as of the recording time. We're recording this on Tuesday morning. And we are not in our usual location, or at least current usual location is your office, Frank, which is currently under occupation. So we are off campus.
That's right.
Secure and undisclosed location.
Yes, we're at my house, my flat, and we are on day 7 of 8 days of strike action by the University and Colleges Union, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But as you say, one of the local twists to this story is that students in sympathetic to our cause. And the industrial action have occupied the David Hume Tower where my office is. And so the David Hume Tower is currently under occupation. We wouldn't have crossed the picket line to record this anyway, but it remains to be seen that when the strike ends, this particular round of strikes ends tomorrow, whether the students will end their occupation or not. So I may be out of my office for a little bit longer.
Well, you have a very nice apartment. So
thank you.
You've got alternative locations for work, if that's... right. So one of the issues in the strike action has to do with what is called casualization here in the UK, but would probably, for American listeners, probably the adjunctification is probably the buzzword. So we're going to be bilingual in the educational idioms in this podcast. So we want to talk about that particular crisis in education and why that's part of the strike action, but then sort of link that to some broader changes that are happening in both the transatlantic, but really in the American economy, about the rise of casual work, the rise of contract workers, gig working,
the new economy,
whatever it is you want to call these sort of changes in how people work and how people relate to employment. Because I think in some ways they are related, even if there are some particular things having to do with the academy as to why adjunctification has happened.
Yeah, we should say something about our particular industrial action, though,
yes,
before we start, because we were, as some listeners will know, there was widespread industrial action across UK higher education. I think it was 65 universities went on strike last year in March and February, and we had 20 days of industrial action, I think, spread out over 5 weeks or something
yes.
like that. It was
pretty substantial.
Yeah, it was pretty substantial. The issue then concerned pensions and the change in our the conditions of our pension, or terms and conditions of our pensions, I should say. This time, that's one of the issues, but there are actually, I think, four issues that the UCU balloted us on. So there's the ongoing pension issue, and the details of that are important to us, but not necessarily to most of our listeners. At the moment, the difference seems to be about how the pension fund is valued, and there's a disagreement between the employers and the union about that. So that was, if you will, the kind of starting issue for this dispute. But then other issues, broader issues, have been folded into it, notably pay. According to the union, average pay for academics has declined by 17% since 2009 in real terms. So that's a pretty significant reduction in pay. Insecure contracts and precarity, which is really going to be our theme today, trying to historicize that, and workloads. And so these are all interrelated, of course. But so there are kind of four main issues, if you will: pension, pay, workloads, and
casualization.
Yeah. And so those are all kind of at issue in this particular industrial action. I have to confess, David, I'm not optimistic. You and I were talking off air before we started. I suspect these 8 days of industrial action that we've experienced over the past 2 weeks are likely to be expanded in the new year. It remains to be seen. There haven't been very substantial talks between the union and the employers during these 8 days of strike action, and my sense, and again, this is only a sense, is that we might be in for a prolonged dispute. I hope I'm wrong about that.
I also hope you're wrong, at least in this case. But I think you're right, in as much as I think the obviously we're not partial to whatever the internal negotiations that are happening in London between universities, UK, as sort of, and the union over all these issues. but I don't see any evidence of movement in the negotiations. So, yeah, so this may be a more prolonged event.
So casualization or precarity, yeah. At least in the higher education sense, again, on both sides of the Atlantic, really applies to hiring people, often very young scholars, sometimes either pre-PhD or immediately postdoctoral, to teach courses or, in our case, to take tutorials as well. We pay, I say we as though we're doing it,
yeah, we have,
the university sector, yes. including our own employer, will pay usually younger junior colleagues an hourly rate to do these jobs, either to teach a course or to teach tutorials, again, in the British context, sometimes both. But, you know, I was talking one of our former students and a friend on the picket line yesterday who told me about her experiences teaching at three different universities. I won't name the universities. It's not really important. But she was basically commuting between three major cities in the north of England and Scotland over the course of her week and trying to fit in her own research at the same time. And I don't think this is unusual. And I think so that is an illustration, yeah. I think, of what we're one of the issues at stake in this strike.
Well, so just two things I wanted to add to that. One is I mean, I think you're right to point out this issue is particularly pressing for early career people, but they're not. Oh, it doesn't always mean that the people who are doing it are fresh out of PhD. They're, yeah. One of the things that's happened is that people have ended up in cycles of precarious labor that have gone on. You know, people have been in casual contract with the university for more than a decade, you know, where they are basically doing the job of a permanent faculty member, but without the security and benefits that go along with that. So they have to sort of reapply for the job that they've been doing every single year, not knowing whether they're going to be able to keep that employment. And so some people are doing this where they're working multiple different places. Some people, though, are really actually working in a, what looks like a, from the outside, like a permanent full-time job, but without about the pay that goes along with that, or without the security.
Indeed, I think there is a distinction to be drawn between PhD students to whom we, and I'm using a royal we here, to whom we're giving some experience and if you will, career development. That's how this kind of mess started. It was a sort of, we'll give a little bit of teaching to PhD students as part of their financial aid package, which allows them to get some teaching experience and build their CVs. And that still goes on, although I think there are issues with how that operates. And again, I don't think this is not an Edinburgh-specific comment. And people who, as you say, are in a kind of permanent state of that type of teaching.
Yes.
And I think there is a, one often leads to the other, and the two are closely related, but there is a slight distinction to be drawn, I think, between those two things. I mean, you probably taught as a PhD student.
Yes,
certainly did.
Yeah.
And again, that was seen, you weren't necessarily paid very well, but it was part of your development as a...
developing a CV to get a permanent job.
Right, which, exactly.
And you know, one of the things that people on the outside don't often realize is how much teaching is being done by, and I don't think students always know this, by people in these precarious contracts. I mean, I think students, until industrial actions like this bring them to the fore, don't realize the number of people who are doing coal-facing teaching that are in these precarious contracts and don't know whether they will be there the following semester or the following year.
Well, why would they? I mean, because kids don't understand the way universities work for perfectly
sure.
good reasons.
And I think also, you know, lots of parents who are paying tuition bills don't realize the extent to which the sort of way in which labor has been organized in universities in terms of who's, what the experience that the what are now the average, you know, used to be tenure track was the default experience. Now, the adjunct is the default experience, what that experience is like compared to when they were in university.
That's right. And again, in a kind of defense of students or in this particular case, and I know you aren't being critical of students,
yeah.
If you come in and you're taking a course and the person teaching the course is Dr. So-and-so because they're a postdoctoral, but you don't necessarily know that their contract status means they're only being paid to teach that course as opposed to another doctor who's teaching your course, another person with a PhD who's teaching your other course, who's on a full-time permanent contract. Sure. Those are distinctions that students wouldn't, and we don't advertise those distinctions.
No, we don't.
Because why would you? Well, it's not appropriate to necessarily advertise somebody's contract status. So it's, but the result is that everybody appears to be something when actually we across the sector, and certainly in the United States and UK, are actually on very, very different types of contracts.
Yeah, just to sort of give people a sense of how things have shifted, there's I was just trying to find some numbers, and the percentage of teaching done by adjunct has increased 300% since 1975.
So adjuncts, you're talking about this kind of operation in the American context.
Right. So I mean that's a number from the House Committee on Education and Workforce. The similar thing is happening in the UK. I get the impression, and this is, I haven't done the research to fully articulate this, I get the impression that the UK has, at the moment, less adjunctification than the US does, but is very much headed in that direction.
Yeah, I would agree with that. As somebody who's made their career in the UK and have been here for nearly 30 years, I think it's slightly less pronounced than it is in the US, but I think the pressures are very similar. What we have is, on both sides of the Atlantic, and now I'm referencing the humanities, but you've seen figures going around and memes and charts on social media as well as I have. You know, there's a strong, particularly post-2008, decline in the number of full-time tenure track, or in the UK, permanent academic jobs in the humanities, for example. Yet the numbers are still there of students who need to be taught. So universities feel that they're under a particular pressure. We have to deliver courses to students, but they're unwilling to invest in full-time permanent posts in order to deliver those courses. And so they're resorting to this casual gig economy style of... Basically, the gig economy has come to higher education, which is why we want to talk about the emergence of the gig economy generally.
Well, I mean, and I think going back to sort of before this casualization crisis, adjunctification crisis, you know, I think we need to explain sort of why in the sort of middle part of the 20th century so many academics were tenure track or tenured or permanent, or use whatever terminology is appropriate for the national context. Why in from 1945 until 1975, there was so many courses that were taught by full-time tenured folks. And I think there's a couple of things that were going on then that contributed to that. One is there was a lot more funding for higher education generally, both at the state level and at the federal level in the United States. So state governments used to put on a lot of money into funding state universities, and the state universities control the, 75-90% of the sector.
And that funding paid off. Some of those universities were among the best universities in the world. Thinking about the University of California system, the University of Michigan, and so forth.
Yeah. Right. So the states were putting a huge amount of money into higher education, and the federal government was putting a large amount of money into federal higher education. A lot of it connected with the Cold War. So there was, probably the biggest example of this is the National Defense Education Act from 1958, which is sort of a response to Sputnik, and they're funding all kinds of science and technology and stuff. But there was also all kinds of money pouring in for humanities, for languages, social sciences of various kinds, psychology, as part of that war effort. And so there was a huge amount of money in universities, which meant that they could do a couple of things. One is they could fund permanent members of staff, and they could keep tuition fees very, very low, right? If you look at the amount of what people were paying to go to these good state universities in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they were paying hundreds of dollars per semester, and now they're paying multiple times that. And I think one of the things that's happened with universities, both public universities and private universities are sort of feeding off of this, is the amount of funding has dropped tremendously. Over the last decade alone, $9 billion has been cut from state funding for higher education. That's 30, in many states, that's as much as 30% cut per student. Right. So there's a huge drop off in how much states are funding. The universities don't want to raise tuition more than they have to, but they are raising tuition. We all know the ways in which tuition in the United States and in the UK has increased tremendously in recent years, but especially in the United States. And cutting funding for paying faculty members is one of the ways in which universities have seen, and therefore adjunctification has been incentivized by sort of these financial pressures happening outside of the universities that are shaping them. But I think you're right. It does reflect some bigger changes that are happening in the economy more
yeah, broadly. I mean, that period you cited from 1945 to 1975 in the United States was a period of, to a large extent, and I realize I'm exaggerating slightly for effect, but of full employment and full-time industrial employment. When somebody with a working class, with a blue-collar manufacturing job, could basically support a family on a decent standard of living, and could do so in the expectation that they would have that job for their entire career. There are crucial qualifiers, yes, particularly with regard to race and gender, and there's a big difference between manufacturing and agriculture. I do know that, David. You don't have to. I wish listeners could have seen the look he was giving me. It was a little bit sanctimonious, it must be said. But where you could expect so that also became the kind of social norm and expectation as well.
Yeah.
And because of that, and in fact, this is one reason that the United States has the stupid healthcare system it does, because healthcare was tied to employment then, because full employment was taken as the norm. And in 1955, that was probably the case, with the qualifiers, the appropriate qualifiers. That assuming that was the norm, and of course that was the world the baby boomers grew up in. The baby boomers were the beneficiaries of that investment in higher education. They're now retired and don't want their taxes to go towards paying for universities they're not using. That world has entirely changed, and I think one of the things we discussed off air is the fact that that world, which we took as the norm for work, is actually an anomaly in American history. If you go back to your century, the 19th century, or my century, the 18th century, the gig economy existed then. We just didn't call it that. John Adams's father was a farmer and a shoemaker.
Right. So having multiple levels, kinds of employment, depending on the season. You know, the agricultural season in some ways encouraged people to have multiple income streams.
That's right. Those farm girls in New Hampshire in the early days of industrialization in the 1820s and 30s are doing piecework during the winter. You know, they're manufacturing stuff because
they're snowed in, and
because they're snowed in. Yeah. You know, and so the what we now call the gig economy existed in earlier centuries, and to some extent, well, let me ask you: do you think we're returning to the norm now, and it's just, you know, it's just an awful norm?
Well, so I mean, I think one of the things that
regression to the mean rather than returning to the norm.
Maybe. I mean, I think there is a difference, though, between the kind of piecemeal multiple income streams you have in the pre-industrial society than the kinds of piecemeal industrial labor you have in the late 19th and early 20th century. In as much as for the farm girls who are making,
hats
or shoes or whatever it is, during wintertime, they are relying on some both market-driven and some non-market-driven kinds of economies, that they are not worried so much about from year to year having a place to live, having enough food to eat, because they're subsistence farmers in some ways, and so they are not as tied into the market economy as you get with people later in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, as you know, there's a debate about that in terms of the rise of capitalism.
To be sure, but the idea that you have people who are sort of migrant workers, tramps, emerges in the late 19th century. There's a you know, there's an interesting transition that happens with the word tramp, which is, I think, is sort of the epitome of this kind of casual labor, where it goes from being a verb in the Civil War era. A tramp is something, you know, march that one would make. I tramped across Georgia.
Right.
To being a noun, a person who does that by the, you know, 1870s. And there's a quote I found from Alan.
When does it become pejorative?
Oh, it's pejorative pretty quickly in the 1870s. Okay. A quote from Alan Pinkerton, who was famously known for
being... Scottish bastard.
That's not very helpful, Frank, for people to know who he is.
Glaswegian bastard, in fact.
Also not helpful. Alan Pinkerton ran a quote-unquote detective agency, which did, among other things, break up labor unions in the late 19th century. He said, the tramp has always existed in some form or another and will continue his wanderings until the end of time, but there's no question that he has come into public notice, particularly in America, in a greater extent during the previous decade than ever before.
So what's the date on that?
1877. Right, so I think it's a recognition that you have a community of workers who are very precariously employed that will work, you know, for a day here and a day there and a week somewhere else and are responding in a mobile way to the demands of the economy or the collapses of the economy. And of course you have a number of economic collapses in the late 19th century which do put a huge amount of the labor force into unemployment, right?
When we talked about 1893 last week.
Yeah, but you also have a huge depression in the 1870s, you know, and the idea of having an unemployed population is not something you would have had in the same way, you know, in the early part of the 19th century or in the 18th century, this idea of somebody is unemployed. Well, they, you know, that becomes a category of analysis. You know, and I think one of the things you had in cities like New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Boston and other places is lots of people, the idea of having a permanent job was a really just something that didn't exist for a large percentage of working class people.
Or a career.
Yeah, career. You know, you in some ways it was not that dissimilar to the kinds of working conditions maybe that many migrant workers have today in the United States, you know, where they are working a couple of days in one place, a few days somewhere else. You know, they'd be lining up at the factory before it opens to see if they could find work that day. Much in the same way as you might have migrant workers today, you know, outside of a Home Depot or something, trying to find employment for that day. I think that was actually sort of a mode of labor for many, many Americans in the late 19th and early 20th century. And obviously this caused a huge amount of suffering, where you can't, it's very hard to plan a life when you have precarious employment. Much in the same way, it's very hard to plan, you know, for, and this is obviously something of a leap both chronologically and otherwise. It's very hard for our colleagues who are employed precariously to plan a life for themselves when they don't know one semester to the next whether they're going to have employment, you know. So think about raising a family, buying a house, all these kinds of things. You know, and the real turning point is in the 1930s, I think. To this shift to kind of a permanent long-term employment. And this happens, I think, for two reasons. One is really substantial labor activism during the Great Depression. Groups like the CIO, the American Auto Workers Union, are engaging in really intensive industrial action for better pay, more security in employment. And, you know, that really pushes for the kinds of post-war permanent employment that we think, that many Americans think of as the default, but in some ways is shaped by these very particular characteristics. So you have this sort of bottom-up push for stable employment. You also have employers, I think, increasingly recognizing the benefits of having a permanent, stable workforce, that the idea of sort of Fordism, that if you pay your employees well, they will show up every day, you won't have problems with absenteeism, you won't have people who are constantly looking for better work if they feel that they are valued where they are, that, you know, if you work someplace for 30 or 40 years and you retire with a gold watch or whatever it is, right?
So what is it, can you define Fordism for our listeners?
So Ford, so this is it's labeled as a tribute. It comes from Henry Ford, who famously, the auto manufacturer, who famously paid his employees comparatively well in the early part of the 20th century. And of course, this is for manufacturing the Model T Ford and subsequent models. And part of his rationale was there were multiple, but you know, one, this would reduce absenteeism. The factory only works if you have people show up on time, not hungover, you know, a sort of a stable workforce. So they benefit the production. But he also thought that, well, okay, if I want these people to be able to purchase the product that they're manufacturing, that they would benefit from having a slightly, you know, so he's not doing it out of the goodness of his heart. He has business reasons for doing it. And there's also a sense in Fordism that corporations had responsibilities, had multiple stakeholders in what they were doing. So they had responsibility to their workers, they had responsibilities to their customers, they had responsibilities to the communities that they were located within. And one of the things I think that's happened is that corporations are increasingly, starting in the 1970s, minimizing those other stakeholders in favor of seeing shareholders as being the primary constituency that they are responsible to. You know, so there was a corporate sense of responsibility. Oh, you can't shut down a factory in the 50s or 60s because that would harm the workers and the community of which they are a part. You know, I think increasingly in the post-Fordism model of corporate America, there's this idea, well, you can shut down a factory if it's going to mean higher returns for stockholders, and that's our sole obligation. So, I mean, I think you really start to see this system falling apart, you know, at the end of the 1970s. Part of this has to do with sort of the deindustrialization of America, the rise of the rest of the world in terms of its manufacturing capacity, you know, jobs that were good, strong union jobs being exported, but in some ways that I think there's some problems with that model, but those jobs are in large part manufacturing jobs are disappearing and being replaced by service kinds of jobs, the jobs that are don't benefit as heavily from this kind of Fordist model.
And of course, technology is going to play its part in terms of the what we now term the gig economy. The internet has made that much easier. The gig economy existed before that, demonstrate. Yeah. In fact, you probably did the same research I did. So, gig enters the lexicon in either 1905 or 1915. It comes from jazz and jazz musicians trying to describe jobs. And so, the fact that there's a word for it in 1915, if we take the later date, 104 years, almost 105 years ago, suggests that the concept exists before then.
Yes.
And at least in music. So the gig economy existed throughout, one could argue what we now term the gig economy has existed in some way, shape, or form throughout history. However, technology is going to make that, it makes it much easier. We both have phones sitting on this table, and on those phones we could order food to be delivered here in the next half hour if we wanted to, or book an Airbnb or whatever. And so Craigslist starts in San Francisco in 1995, the very earliest kind of early days of the internet being a commercial entity. And then it kind of, you know, we get Airbnb in 2008 and Uber in 2009. I was surprised Uber's as old as that. And then, of course, Lyft. And there are a million others. I mean, and these have both made our lives much more convenient. But the people who work in those, Amazon. The people who work in those industries are, by their nature, it's precarious work.
The economist Lewis Hyman has argued that really that you know, when we look at employment options, if that's what we want to think about these things as, because they, you know, Uber and Airbnb say the people who work for them are not employees,
right?
And I think that shift from who is an employee and who is not an employee is an important distinction. But Hyman has argued that really that is a byproduct of some bigger changes that are happening for a much larger segment of the working population, where you've got contract workers, alt employment, just-in-time scheduling, that makes things like working for Uber seem like a good alternative. You know, the number of people right now who are working for places like Walmart, working for places like Starbucks, Domino's, which I think places I've worked.
You're working in service industries and retail.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's happened, and I think the technology has helped corporations do this, is it's made working at those places much more challenging for the people who work there. They have just-in-time scheduling. So
yeah, what does that mean, David?
Well, so you don't have a regular schedule week to week. You don't know how many hours you're going to work in a given week. So the way that these corporations sort of sell this, they say, oh, we're flexible with our scheduling, so that's good for people with families or people who are students, which may or may not be the case, but it affects all the workers, even people who want full-time employment, where you learn on a Sunday night how much you're going to be working that week. And so you may work 30 hours one week, might work 20 hours another week, which makes obviously budgeting and things very difficult. But knowing which hours you're going to work every day is going to be different. So one week you'll work in the mornings, the next week you'll work in the evenings. Sometimes you have this these situations where you will close the store one night and you'll open it again the next morning. And if you're working at a Starbucks, that means you're closing it at midnight and you're opening it at 6 a.m., which I've done. It's not pleasant. But also, you can show up for work and you might be scheduled for a 6-hour shift, and an hour into it, the manager says, we don't need you anymore for today, go home. And so that you've got, 5 hours of not getting paid that you had sort of budgeted for being paid. And so there's this kind of precariousness to even corporate employment that makes things like working for, Uber seem appealing, because the working Uber is, doesn't seem like it's not good employment, but it's only good employment in light of what the alternatives are. And so I think you're having most of the new jobs being created are in this sort of contract work model, where people are either not technically employees, or if they are employees, they don't have the kind of security and regularity that workers a generation had before had. Lots of these jobs are part-time jobs, but you have to sort of give the corporation your availability as if it were a full-time job, which makes it very hard to cobble together multiples of these jobs simultaneously.
But but because Uber drivers are not employees of Uber,
yes,
they're theoretically making their own hours,
yes,
right? So they're not facing that difficulty because they...
But they're all, but a lot of what they're doing is they're working at Starbucks and driving...
I understand that. And indeed, it strikes me that with Uber and Airbnb in particular, which I think are the kind of archetypes of the gig economy, that when they started, at least one way they were kind of sold to people, it was almost like the distinction I drew earlier at the beginning of this chat, about giving PhD students some teaching, which would allow them to develop their careers and earn a little bit of money, and it'd be part of a financial aid package, as opposed to it being something you did because you couldn't do something else, and so it was all together. Similarly, Uber was meant to be, you have a job, but if you want to do a bit of driving on nights and weekends, you could do that to earn some extra money.
Soccer mom, you can do this while,
And similarly, an Airbnb was, I've got a spare bedroom, so I'll rent it out. And this is basically a website that allows me to do that. And both of them have morphed into something considerably different in the same way that teaching for PhD students has morphed into adjunctification or casualization, as we say here. So I think that in all three of those examples, which are very different, we see a similar kind of trend.
Yes.
And I'm not sure, so I can describe it. I'm not sure I can provide a solution. Or even come up with an alternative. I mean, do you use Uber?
I have on occasion.
Right.
I don't use it regularly, but there are times where I've used it. Because in some ways, it's a good service. And
well, if you're a consumer...
Yes, as a service, it's pretty good.
It's a great service, actually, compared to taxis.
Yes.
Which, at least in major American cities, are awful.
Yeah.
As somebody who travels a fair bit, I mean, the convenience, the way you pay. And I often speak to Uber drivers about their conditions, because Uber was getting rightly criticized a few years ago, particularly for its paying conditions. And so this concerns me. And it's been interesting to talk to Uber drivers and in both the UK and in the US, where I've mainly used Uber. I won't say, oh, they're happy with it, because I think that would be an exaggeration. Yeah. But I think I find it interesting to speak to Uber and Lyft drivers, because Lyft is a similar service, of course. Because I think that to a certain extent, they are at the cutting edge of the new economy in ways that we are not.
Yeah.
We're like those people who had kind of permanent jobs in the middle of the 20th century.
Yes, we've been very fortunate.
Yeah, we're extremely fortunate, but that's not the norm anymore.
No, it's not.
That is not the norm. And so I found it very interesting to speak to them. And some of them... Of course, it's a lottery. You never know who you're going to get. Some of them seem quite happy with it, or say they are, and some are not. And it depends on what else they've got going on, I guess. But it gives you a real insight into the way the gig economy works. When you ask them, how many hours a week do you drive?
Yeah.
And it's often staggering.
Yes. So it's yes. And in profoundly unhealthy ways, and ways that are, probably unsafe.
Sure. I was going to say, to go back to where we started in terms of our own industry.
Yeah, we can't fix the broader economy. But
no, I mean, again, Uber's difficult because on one hand, I think there was a moment a couple of years ago when it was sort of socially unacceptable to use Uber because of some of the stories we were hearing. I think they've improved a lot of that aspect of it, but Uber's just really convenient and by comparison with taxis.
Yeah.
And works better than taxis in most major cities. So that's not going back, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I want to think about our business, because we're on strike right now. We're giving up 8 days' pay for, in part, over this issue of casualization of labor. And this is in our own profession. This is in our own... this is in a sector that's near and dear to us in higher education.
Mm.
We talked a little bit off air before we started. What's the solution, David? Because I can see where the union and the employer, Universities UK, can reach a compromise about the pension, right?
Yeah.
That's undoubtedly what they'll do. They'll split the difference on this, that, or the other thing, and the valuation and contributions and all that sort of thing. Those negotiations, that's the nature of negotiating. It seems to me these other aspects, like insecure contracts, pay something they could compromise on.
Mm.
Workloads, things like this, are more vitally important,
but
also much more difficult to reach a sector-wide settlement over.
Yeah. Well, one thing, just one advantage we have here is that we are both members of the union, and therefore are able to engage in industrial action in a way that many American colleagues can't.
Yeah, that's true.
I've taught in places where it was illegal for me to be part of a union because it was a state, entity and whatnot. And so there was prohibitions against you couldn't go on strike. So I think the fact that we have a union, not just for this university, but across the entire sector, that represents people, who are at,
60 universities are on strike.
Yes, so it's from a range of different kinds of institutions and sizes and missions. I think that is a real help, right? I think if you look at just going back to the 1930s, one part of the reason why you ended up in the situation where people had permanent long-time employment in auto work and other kinds of manufacturing jobs is because working people joined labor unions, the American Auto Workers, and various things associated with the CIO, that pushed for, through industrial action, strikes, those kinds of concessions and guarantees from employers. So I think I think our union has done an extraordinary job this time. They seem to be really well organized, and I think that the people or members of the union are doing extraordinary work at the picket lines here and across the country. I think that's really important. And it would be great to see a parallel entity exist in the United States, but the sort of landscape of universities and labor law across the United States makes that very, very difficult. And I think that's in some ways by design to inhibit this kind of action. And I think to the extent to which we have some better working conditions than our American counterparts, that has to do with the strength of our union. I think universities have to make choices about what's really important. And I think, having the thing about adjuncts, people on casual contracts, is they are some of the best teachers out there. They work extraordinarily hard, and they are not getting rewarded for it like they ought to. And so the universities do exploit casual labor because people are so precarious. And I think that's, it's bad for the, people who are on these casual contracts. It's bad for their health. And it's bad for those of us who are on permanent contracts, because I think there's this sort of escalating cycle of overwork that's part of universities everywhere, but seems to be particularly pronounced at the moment. How to fix it?
Yeah, how do we fix it? And I realize I don't have a solution, so well, that's why I'm asking you the question.
So I think we need to do a couple of things. Union members need to explain the situation better to our students and other stakeholders, whether that's parents of our students, to people of the general public, about what's going on, because I think people are not aware of it. As you mentioned, like, students don't know who is on a permanent contract and who's not, right? And I think explaining the ways in which having staff on temporary contracts and precarious contracts is actually bad for students.
It'd be interesting if universities had to report those figures.
Right.
In their perspectives.
Right. Yeah. Because, they are bad for students. One of the things that we as permanent faculty members can do is we develop a relationship with students over their 4 years at university, or 3 years at university if you're in England. And we can write letters of recommendation for them because we've seen them develop over time. If somebody is employed for teaching a module here and something else there, and who knows where they're going to be the following year, there's actually meaningful things they can't do for that student, no matter how hard they're working, right? And so I think we need to persuade people that this is actually bad for students and bad for the mission of the university as a whole, because I think the union can do a lot by itself, but I think the union working in conjunction with a sort of a public that understands why we're on strike and what's at stake can make a huge amount of difference. And I'm hoping that we can sort of create, sort of turn back the tide. And I realize that we're maybe fighting a losing battle here in the long term, but the extent to which we can forestall greater casualization, I think that would be in and of itself at least a small victory. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that this is a really tricky question, because I think there are real... we'll stipulate this is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. We don't need to rehearse that. We've been doing that for the past few minutes. As far as the solution, I think... metrics are really important to universities on both sides of the Atlantic. Rankings and league tables are really, really important. So I think if institutions that care, or the kind of organizations that create these rankings, whether it's U.S. News and World Reports in the U.S. or the Times Higher Education Supplement here in the U.K. Or the QS World Rankings, if they
factored this in heavily.
If they factored it into their metrics, I think that's something universities would respond to,
yeah.
because universities are acutely aware of these league tables, and I think that would be
and try to game them.
Do try to game them. Of course they do, but I think that would be a bit of naming and shaming would be quite effective in this way. So I think that's one thing that could be done. It requires accurate information. You need a standard if you're going to do this. And for reasons, there are legitimate HR reasons and privacy reasons that relate to this, but also, and data protection issues, but this is not information the universities are willing to share in most cases. But if they were, at least in the UK, where almost all of the institutions are publicly funded, they could be compelled to share it. And if they were compelled to share this information, that might lead to an improvement. It's so just as there's a job of work to be done informing our key stakeholders, particularly students, but also their parents, I think if the public at large were aware of this, and particularly our funders, which is mainly the state, that might have an impact. If you look at, so we're subject to something, discussion for another topic, the Research Excellence Framework, which is a kind of intermittent assessment of our research output mandated by the government. Well, the government could, and there's something called the Teaching Excellence Framework, which is the teaching equivalent, which pertains in mainly in England, but less so in Scotland. The government could demand this information and universities would have to produce it.
Yeah, they demand all kinds of other information.
Yes, that's right. And if they did, if it did, that might change the dynamic considerably. Because I think that, I suspect that many institutions don't realize the degree of casualization that's going on within their institutions. Because it often happens locally. So to take Edinburgh as an example, and I don't think Edinburgh is necessarily particularly virtuous or egregious. I think it's probably typical for its size. Edinburgh consists of 21 different schools. Those schools have a degree of local autonomy and organize their teaching locally. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of casualization that's going on locally. And it would only be in seeing it in the aggregate that it would truly become apparent. Yeah. And I think the state is an external funding body, and I'm using the state generally, could compel universities to produce this information, and this information would be quite revealing.
All right. Well, hopefully
you're giving me a look like you don't think they know.
Well, no, I think they do, because I think they do know. Principals here and other universities have been asked about this, and they say, "Oh, yes, we know it's an issue," but they've sort of whitewashed it, saying, "Oh, people who are on casual contracts usually want to be on casual contracts."
Right, but what I'm saying is, I think if they're given a percentage, if the vice chancellor of the University of X is told the percentage of teaching delivered at your institution by casually employed lecturers and tutors is 38%, or 58%, I don't know, but your local rival at University Y, it's 28%, I think that would respond to that.
It's name and shame. Okay, good.
I think that would be an important step. So we're academics. We always want data. We always want information. Yes. So I think gathering this information would be an important first step.
Yeah. I think we also have to then sort of rethink the business model of the university and the ways in which universities are increasingly, being told by various outside people that they should be run like businesses, which causes some of this, I think, short-term thinking in terms of, what's the cheapest way we can deliver the content we need to deliver?
Yeah, we need to go back to the fact that teaching is the core activity of the university. It's not a core activity, it's the core activity.
It's why the university is there.
Exactly, and the other stuff arises from that.
Mm. Yes.
But it's the core activity as far as... And once you take that as a premise, you wouldn't necessarily... we're talking about institutions that are worth hundreds of billions of pounds.
Yes.
You wouldn't necessarily give your most vulnerable employees this core activity.
Right. Exactly. This is the...
Google doesn't say, okay, this is our core activity, so we're going to have the least... I mean, and I'm not saying we should emulate Google's working practices, but we would give our most important activity to the people we pay the least.
Right.
And treat the worst.
To be sure.
And so we need to return to first principles and gather data,
I guess. All right. That sounds like a good good plan. But until then, we will be on strike and picketing and all kinds of things.
So, David, what's your last drop?
Yeah, last drop. So I just, in terms of something sort of lighthearted after this very fairly depressing but I saw a really great movie earlier this week it's not particularly historical, other than the fact that it's harkening back to a type of film which is out of fashion at the moment, but used to be quite popular. And it's a film called Knives Out. You haven't seen
it? I have not seen this.
It's by Rian Johnson, who directed, I guess, the last Star Wars film. But it's a murder mystery in the sort of Agatha Christie style, where you've got a detective who is trying, you know, in a Victorian house, who's trying to figure out who did it. But it's got an all-star cast. You know, it's got Chris Evans in it. It's got Jamie Lee Curtis. It's got Christopher Plummer. It's got just does like everybody in it. It's a star. But if you like that kind of very tightly plotted with 8 plot twists along the way kind of murder mystery, that is both reverential of that genre of film, but also has some fairly contemporary social commentary in it. Knives Out is really, really good.
All right,
and okay, it's a good. It's a nice like 2 hour.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, but it's one of those 2 hours that actually feels like it's like an hour, you know. And so it's really, you're always kind of, there's no dead time in it. So it's really, really an excellent film. So Knives Out for this.
Excellent. Really like good. That kind of thing. Well, I also have a film. It's a little.
Is it 2 hours, Frank?
Well, actually, this is ironic, because as David will know, and some listeners may know, one of my complaints is that films are way too long, and the film I'm about to recommend is a little indie film I'm sure nobody's heard of called The Irishman, and so The Irishman is Martin Scorsese's latest film. It was in cinemas only briefly. I saw it in the movies here a couple of weeks ago, and I've now seen it on Netflix, because it was produced by Netflix and it's been released on Netflix. I think it had a cinematic release so that it will be Oscar eligible.
Okay.
I'm guessing that must have been the thinking. So it was out in the cinemas for about 2 weeks. I mean, it really was brief. It is so long. It's 3.5 hours. And in fact, my one complaint about it is it's too long.
Couldn't they have just made that like a Netflix series and have them like seven and a half hour episodes?
Yes, it could have been. Yeah. And indeed, I think that in thinking about the Oscars, I mean, I think the Oscars were a factor there. Oh, okay. So it wanted to, and remember, Scorsese who directed this had a bit of a shot at the Marvel Cinematic Universe about a month ago. And so I think he thinks in terms of films.
Okay, to be sure. So, he's never done television, I guess, so.
Well, he made, I think, did he make the pilot for Boardwalk Empire?
Okay,
I think he might have.
Right.
But yes, he's mainly done movies, and he's known for films. It's about, it's very complicated. It's a mob epic, which of course is Scorsese's, his jam, as it were. It profiles a man named Frank Sheeran. He's the Irishman, played by Robert De Niro. It is interesting that in two of Scorsese's most famous films, I would argue, The Irishman and in Goodfellas, he cast Robert De Niro, who one would say is an archetypal Italian-American actor, as an Irish guy, Irish-American. So he plays this guy, Frank Sheeran, who's a mob hitman in Philadelphia. And in Goodfellas, is he Jimmy Dugan? Anyway, he plays an Irish character, Irish-American character. And it's got Joe Pesci and Al Pacino. Al Pacino plays Jimmy Hoffa, the great union team leader of the Teamsters.
Yeah, yeah.
So this relates to our theme about the biggest union in America in the middle of the 20th century. It's a multi-layered plot. It's, I would argue, actually Shakespearean, because there's a tragic element to this. I won't spoil it for you, but Jimmy Hoffa dies. I'm going to give that away. But how he dies and the relationship that leads to his
death.
Does
it say where he's buried?
It does not. but it all builds to that. And what's interesting is it takes place over about a 30-year period, and the main actors in this, Pacino, Joe Pesci, and Robert De Niro, are all in their mid to late 70s.
Yes.
And so they do a little bit of a trick with technology, and they de-age them.
Mm.
Robert De Niro plays, the character he plays also ages considerably. So we see him from the Second World War down to when he's in a nursing home in the early 21st century.
Okay.
And they do it pretty well, Where it doesn't work is they're not really action sequences. There's a scene where Robert De Niro beats up a grocer, and he's walking down the street. He's meant to be middle-aged at this point with his young daughter.
Yeah.
He's angry, and he's walking down the street, but he's walking like a 75-year-old man, because he is a 75-year-old man.
They would just have a body.
Well, yes, you would have thought that. But the aging aspect actually works really well. You get used to that, you forget it. The acting is great. Joe Pesci's really, really good.
Really? Okay.
And in fact, I think he steals the show. But as historians, it really captures the zeitgeist of the middle of the 20th century, the very period we've been talking about, the kind of dirty underside of it, very well. There's a scene in 1975 where Robert De Niro's character is speaking to Joe Pesci's character, and they're sitting in a Howard Johnson's. Mm. And Howard Johnson's no longer exists, of course, but if you remember what a Howard Johnson's was like in the 70s, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Not that Howard Johnson's was a perfect experience in the 1970s, but
it was just an iconic experience.
It is iconic. Yeah. The furniture's right. The coffee cups are perfect. It's just, it captures that zeitgeist perfectly. It's very tightly plotted. A lot of black humor. It's actually quite funny.
Okay.
It's about 25 minutes too long.
All right.
So it
should be 3 hours.
Should be 3 hours. Okay. I don't think many films should be over an hour and 45 minutes. So the fact I'm willing to concede 3 hours is a big statement on my part. So it's definitely worth your time now that it's on Netflix. You can watch it in installments.
Exactly.
So watch it in...
Take restroom breaks.
Yeah, exactly. Because seeing it... But it was great in the cinema, I will say that. But 3.5 hours is way too long for a movie.
Should have an intermission or something.
Yeah.
Lawrence of Arabia.
That's right. And they did it... Was it Reds where they had an intermission? I think. Yeah. I mean, it's a rare movie that should be more than 2 hours in my view. I would recommend The Irishman. So if you're looking for something to watch it, I was able to watch it on installments because we went on strike. So anyway.
Recover from the picket lines.
That's right. Cheers. Anyway, cheers, David.
Cheers in solidarity.
Yep.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.